I introduce Professor Edward Wieringer from Rochester, who will be speaking to us today about the fetus, proper functioning, and the evolution argument against naturalism. And we'll begin with comments by Professor Tim O'Connor, who is our visitor from the University of Indiana.
All right. Great, thanks. So I wanted to start off with a couple of amazing stories about Billy Dunaway, whom we all know and love. But Billy, just now, having been alerted and tipped off that I would do this, has bribed me, and so I can't tell you these things. But he was a little hasty in the promise he extracted for me in exchange for the bribe, so I said I would not publicly share these stories. But privately, that's all bets are off. So see me afterwards if you'd like to hear those stories. Okay, they're very good. The handout is Ed's handout, which you should have. There are not one, but two, because we were a little bit unclear in communicating with the staff. There's a single-sided handout, which I scrunched down Ed's original three-page handout onto it. And the handouts are over there, which my kind assistant is about to pass around. But there's also a stack of the stapled handouts. That's same contents with a bibliography added, but it has an extra page, bigger font. So you can have one of those if you prefer. Same content.
They might have disappeared.
Sorry?
Be gone.
Oh, they may be gone. They may be gone. Never mind that. Okay, let me get going. Since Ed has such a nice summary handout of his argument, I'm actually going to be really brief in summarizing his paper, just kind of walk through some of the highlights. Then I'm going to go ahead and give my my comments, my reactions to it, and then turn it over to Ed. So Ed starts off by talking about how Al Plantinga thought in various writings about defeat. I should say Ed was Al's student, so he's kind of impiously critiquing Al in various places. But I guess you're old enough to do that. Okay. And he notes that in the end, in terms of his sort of mature account of Warrant, Plantinga wants to define the notion of defeat in terms of proper function. And I'm going to say something about that in my comments. So he starts off by drawing our attention to that. And then he summarizes, tells you a bit about how you should think about what Plantinga's doing, why he's characterizing Warrant as he does. And you have that on the front page of your handout. And then at the bottom, he summarizes the account without a couple of riders that aren't relevant for our purposes. A belief is warranted for a person provided that it is produced by that person's properly functioning cognitive faculties, successfully aimed at truth, operating in circumstances they were designed to operate. So then the notion of defeat, there's a little bit of possibly tension between some of the things, or you could easily put it this way, some of the informal glosses on defeat you could easily read in a certain sort of way. So Ed draws our attention to his Al's formal statement about the nature of defeat, which is in the middle of your second side of your handout, is that right? Sorry, I'm working from two different handouts. It's at the very top. He calls our attention to clause two, right? So a defeater is a purely epistemic defeater of B for S of T if and only if condition two, any person S star whose cognitive faculties are functioning properly in the relevant respects, yada, 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 would withhold B. So it's a proper function. So we want to know whether something defeats something, we need to know, well, what would an ideal, properly functioning agent do, right? That's what the account tells us. Al notes that given that this role of proper function, then this notion of proper function comes up in, it's an integral part of the account of Warrant itself. And this leads him to say that defeat does not play a role in securing knowledge. It's not an independent factor, relevant feature. If you want to determine whether an agent knows something, attending to defeat as a kind of condition along the way of determining whether you think it's plausible to judge that someone knows something, it's not going to play a role in your determination, right? And so that you have on... I have too many different sheets going, my old sheet and new sheet. That he says right at the beginning of section three. All right, so all of this is then in service of looking at Al's infamous evolutionary argument against naturalism. And the argument's laid out for you right there on the handout. If R is a very general proposition that our cognitive faculties are reliable, N is the thesis that metaphysical naturalism is true, and E is the statement that our cognitive faculties have developed by way of the mechanisms to which contemporary evolutionary theory appeals. So then Al, Ed doesn't talk about Al's reasons for judging the first premise of the argument to be true, and he says, let's just assume that Al's right about that, although of course there's quite a bit of discussion about that. That is the conditional probability judgment that R, given an evolutionary account of the origins of our cognitive faculties and metaphysical naturalism, which then that conjunction tells us that in a ultimate sense, the processes giving rise to our cognitive faculties are unguided. That conditional probability is low. Sometimes, in some statements of the argument, he says it's either low or it should be judged inscrutable. But let's say, suppose it's low. Suppose you judge that it's low. Then the argument proceeds. Premise two, anyone who accepts, that is, believes, the conjunction of metaphysical naturalism and the evolution, a broad kind of evolutionary picture of cognitive origins, and sees that that conditional probability is low, has a defeater for the R, for the reliability premise, for the reliability assumption that we make. At any rate, for R, whether or not we make it or not, right? You have a defeater for R. Premise three, anyone who has a defeater for R has a defeater for any other belief she has, including N and E itself. R, right, the consequences of coming to have a defeater for R are catastrophic, because it cascades right through all of your beliefs, because then when you reflect that every particular belief you have is called into question once the general reliability thesis is called into question for you. Four, so if one who accepts the conjunction of N and E thereby acquires a defeater for N and E is self-defeating though, right? The problem is, if we then turn this problem onto the conjunction of N and E itself, and so it can't rationally be accepted. So conclusion, N and E can't rationally be accepted. Question then becomes what you're supposed to do if you bought all of this. Al says somewhat different things, I think, in different places when he gives versions of the argument. All right, finally, what's Ed's take on this? Ed's take on this is that actually Al's wrong about the significance of coming to believe that the a posteriori probability of R, even if you sort of work it through and you say, okay, so I should judge the probability of R itself to be low, Ed says this doesn't impact, right? It leaves intact your knowledge or justification for any of your particular beliefs, because Ed says, plausibly, most of your particular beliefs aren't premised on R. That's not part of your evidence for R, right? For the particular belief, like this is a hand, right? If I ask what's your evidence for this is a hand, you're not going to point to R as one of your bits of evidence. So no problem. So Al's just wrong about the consequences of buying the initial structure of the argument. Okay. If we think about defeat in a more typical way in terms of evidential relations among propositions, the impact of defeaters. Now, if we think about defeaters in Al's way, in terms of proper function, and we think, what would a properly functioning cognitive system do in the face of this seeming tension, right? Surely, proper function would not bid us to just abandon ship, you know, abandon all our beliefs. Al, think about what Al says about what a theist ought to do in the face of the potential rebutting evidence of brought forth by the argument from evil, right? And other such considerations. Al says, well, presumably, if God does in fact exist, and God is ultimately the designer behind the natural processes giving rise to our cognitive faculties, then God's intentions, so ultimately, you know, proper function has to do with how God has intended our cognitive system to function, would not be to abandon theism, because God wants us to have theistic beliefs. Well, presumably, God is similarly not going to want the metaphysical naturalist to engage in cognitive despair and draw these kinds of, you know, pervasively this pessimistic conclusion, and so cease to have any positive beliefs. Okay. So now I'm going to turn to my remarks. So there's a very brief summary, and Ed, if you feel like I've overlooked something that needs to be emphasized, just go ahead and run with it in the discussion. So I think of Al's argument, I like his argument. I've written not just one, but two papers on the argument. I think it's a fun argument, and it's an exemplar of an uncompelling but clever and interesting argument that's fruitful, right? It causes us to think about some issues that we might not otherwise think about. And what I want to do is three things, briefly. First, to suggest that on Plantinga's account, telling whether or not a person's belief is defeated is, I think, his considered view is that at least sometimes required in order to tell whether or not it is a case of knowledge. Right, it is a step along the way to determining whether or not a person has knowledge in the face of the defeater. I get the impression that Ed thinks otherwise, as I'll explain, but I might be mistaken about that. Second, I will suggest that we ought to resist Plantinga's supernaturalization of the notion of cognitive design plan that is central to his account of Warrant. The notions of cognitive design plan and proper function are closely related notions. And what Al wants to say is, if theism is true, we should think about this in a kind of super, ultimately in terms of God's intentions, right? That's going to be the ultimate round of whether or not proper, whether or not a system is functioning properly. It's the source, I think Al's making that move is the source of the implausible asymmetry in his handling of highly general potential undercutting or rebutting defeaters for theism on the one hand and for metaphysical naturalism on the other hand. Right, and that's what's kind of driving the asymmetry, the way Al thinks about how the metaphysical naturalist and the theist should respond to potential defeaters. And then this will put me in place to say, thirdly, what I think one ought to say, or some of what one ought to say, about Al's evolutionary argument against naturalism. Although, like Ed, I think the argument is unconvincing, my reply to it is different from Ed's, and I'll explain why I don't follow Ed here. All right, so Plantinga's account of defeat. Ed says that on Plantinga's account, telling whether or not a person's belief is defeated is not necessarily required in order to tell whether or not it is a case of knowledge. I think this is right for a special reason I'll get to shortly. But I get the impression that Ed thinks something stronger, namely that telling whether or not a person's belief is defeated, for Al, is never required in order to tell whether or not it is a case of knowledge. Though Ed never says it explicitly, what gives me this impression is the way he reasons to the more limited interpretive claim. As Plantinga thinks of it, a warranted true belief is necessarily knowledge. That's part of how he defines the term warrant. Ed rightly observes that because of this way of characterizing warrant, if a person's belief is warranted, it follows that it is not defeated. And this observation leads Ed to say further that the crucial test is whether a belief is warranted, and that, quote, the concept of defeat does not play a role in securing knowledge, end quote. I'm unclear on exactly what point Ed meant to be making in this passage on page 10 of his paper. It does not follow from the fact that no defeat is not an independent condition on knowledge from warrant, that we don't need to assess whether there is defeat in a particular instance in order to assess whether there is knowledge. But, Ed might say, notice that Plantinga's characterization characterizes defeat in terms of proper function, which is also a condition on warrant. That suggests we must have an independent handle on what it is to function, to properly function, in response to a candidate defeater. So it looks like we simply apply the proper function test, along with the others, relevant to warrant, in order to decide whether a given belief is a case of knowledge. Hence, Ed's remark that, again, the concept of feet does not play a role in securing knowledge. But we need to be careful here. One could follow Plantinga in thinking that proper function is a more fundamental epistemic notion than that of defeat, and yet also think that in some cases, perhaps a great many cases, our only means of determining whether a person would be functioning properly by retaining or, as the case may be, giving up a given belief upon acquiring some further beliefs, is to determine whether having those further beliefs constitute a defeater of the target belief for that person. In a given context, our thinking about plausible conditions of defeat might be the horse driving our thinking about what it is, the cart of what it is to properly function in that context. And I think that Plantinga believes that it is so necessary, at least in some cases. So far as I can see, I might be wrong. Michael will know if I'm wrong, so he'll quickly clarify this for us. As I recall, I didn't go back and look at all the relevant places in Plantinga, but as far as I can recall, the only or main reason that Plantinga thinks this is not true in general, and hence we need to define defeat partly in terms of proper function, has to do with the special case of theistic belief. Belief in theism is a very special case in Plantinga's epistemology because of theism's integral connection, as Al sees it, with how we ought to understand the epistemic notion of proper function. And it impacts what we might otherwise be led to say about whether there are or could be viable undercutting or rebutting defeaters to theistic belief. Hence, I think it unwise to draw a general conclusion about the role of defeaters in securing knowledge on Plantinga's account from what he says about the case of theistic belief that Ed talks about in the paper. All right, so much for that. Second comment. Central to Plantinga's account of warrant is the notion of proper cognitive function in belief-producing mechanisms aimed at truth. Proper function is a teleological notion, that of functioning in accordance with the design plan of one's cognitive system. If classical theism is true, the ultimate origin of our cognitive system is God, albeit mediated by a long evolutionary process, which God intended to have that very result. Plantinga draws from this the further significant conclusion for epistemology. If theism is true, proper function will not necessarily supervene on the natural psychological and physical facts about actual function, or even on those facts together with those candidate epistemic norms that might seem correct, independent of acceptance of theism. God's intentions about the circumstances under which we form, sustain, or modify our beliefs is an independent further condition on proper function. To function properly is, in the end, to function as God intends, if theism is true. This does not lead Plantinga into skepticism, since he judges it reasonable to suppose that God's intentions for how our cognitive system ought to function, his design plan for us, aligns pretty closely to what we might think from simple empirical observations of how we do function when we are functioning reliably in our normal context. However, a priori reflection should lead us, Plantinga thinks, to suppose that God intends for us to easily acquire knowledge of himself and his purposes for human beings, and for us not to be inclined to easily abandon theistic belief. At any rate, reflection, Plantinga thinks, reflection on Christian teaching about God should lead us to suppose these things. As Ed noted, Plantinga puts this thought to work in considering putative undercutting defeaters to theistic belief, those suggested by Marx and Freud that he talks about specifically, and the putative rebutting defeater constituted by the facts concerning human and animal suffering. Plantinga contends first that theism is consistent with either of the accounts of the origins of religious belief offered by Marx and Freud, and with the facts of evil. They're consistent. Even so, to pick just one case, that God would intend for humans to come to certain theistic beliefs in the way that Freud suggested will seem very surprising to most reflective theists. Perhaps a particular theist, Lara, assigns a low conditional probability to Freud's theory being true on theism. So far, so good, because she does not accept the theory. But now suppose, through a combination of misinformation and the gullibility of youth, she later comes to accept it. What ought she to do? How would a properly functioning human respond? Plantinga suggests that it is unlikely that God, if he exists, intends for Lara to abandon her theistic belief in the face of this new belief. So, probably, he judges, if theism is true, then Lara would not function properly if she were to conditionalize on her newly acquired belief and greatly reduce her credence in theism. What should she do instead? Presumably, hit the reset button. Modify her original estimate of the conditional I don't know that Al says this, but I take it to be a plausible development of what he says. Presumably hit the reset button, modify her original estimate of the conditional probability. Not because further reflection suggests to her that she was too hasty in her original estimate of the conditional probability, but just because that's what God's design specifies. Whether or not Laura knows or believes this. On the other hand, if theism is false, then what she ought to do, Plantinga allows, is to conditionalize, as one ought to do in most contexts, and so weaken her confidence in theism. So it all depends on whether theism is true, whether or not what she ought to do. So, on Plantinga's account, proper function does not supervene on the purely natural facts and the epistemic norm, I'm putting this kind of loosely, the epistemic norms we might judge to be plausible when we don't consider any role God might have in fixing those norms. Speaking for myself, I'm not happy with this consequence. Why not? I guess it's because, while I'm a theist, I don't find it plausible that our concept of knowledge is so closely tied to God's intentions concerning what we believe. Insofar as we find a broadly proper functionalist account of knowledge plausible, it's because we're thinking of proper function in more or less naturalistic terms. Furthermore, I don't find it plausible to think that God so much as has intentions for us to respond to evidence in formally distinctive ways when it comes to embracing or maintaining belief in theism or atheism. Christianity teaches that God has lots of general intentions regarding what happens among us that are not realized, at least in the short run. God may well intend that every human person have a firm and confident belief in God, and lots else besides. But that doesn't give us much reason to suppose that he has specifically designed us to handle evidence in peculiar ways so that his intentions in this sphere get realized more quickly than they otherwise might, given the epistemic environment we happen to be in. If that is right, then someone, including a theist, who likes Plantinga's broad picture of warrant, can and should define defeat independently of the notion of proper function in terms of evidentiary relations in some way. Okay, now, third point, assessing the evolutionary argument against naturalism. Ed's response to this argument, that again is on your handout, in basic terms is to say that even if one has a defeater for the proposition that our cognitive beliefs are generally reliable, the proposition R, it does not follow that one has a defeater for everything else she believes. A defeater for this general proposition, quote, can leave intact a person's justification for specific propositions, such as that one has a hand. He argues this by way of cases. One, first case, he says, if we follow Plantinga's proper functionalist account of defeat, it seems implausible that we are designed, whether by nature or nature's God, to withhold all our former beliefs on the basis of such a theoretical consideration as the conditional probability of R on N and E. That seems right to me, so I'll say no more about it. Two, suppose, on the other hand, we think of defeat not as Al does, in terms of his formal definition, but we think of it in broadly evidential terms. Here, Ed thinks we can dismiss the relevance of S's having a defeater for R by noting that people typically don't believe that, for example, that they have hands on the basis of the general proposition R. He notes that one need not even believe R in order to be justified in believing various things, such as that one has hands. One might not believe it because one's never considered it, but still you're justified in believing that you have hands. But surely more needs to be said here. And so if we don't follow Al in terms of how we, in the kind of theistically driven way of thinking about proper function in response to putative defeaters, I don't think that's good enough to just say that, right? One may not believe R because one has not so much as considered it. So one neither believes it, disbelieves it, nor actively resists either of those attitudes, as Mike characterizes withholding. But once one does entertain it and sees its very sweeping consequences concerning the epistemic status of one's belief, it seems to me the situation shifts. Suppose an unlikely scenario where Maria judges that the conditional probability of R on N and E is low, accepts that N and E, and concludes that the a posteriori probability of R itself is low. Surely all is not well with Maria, epistemically. There is now a deep evidential inconsistency in Maria's beliefs, insofar as she assigns high probability to various specific claims, low probability to R, and sees that the probability of those specific claims is low, conditional on R's being low. Well, what ought she to do? I say, hit the reset button. It's all well and good to suppose, as a general matter, that the probability of R on N and E is low. Anyways, let's grant this for the sake of argument. But the unconditional probability of R is another matter. Massive incoherence results from assigning it anything, insofar as one assigns it a probability at all, massive incoherence results from assigning it anything but a very high credence, conditional on all one's actual evidence. Much as Plantinga wants to say concerning theism, but more plausibly, I think, R is a singular case where special rules apply. One way to hit the reset button is to abandon N and embrace T and the belief that the probability of R on T, so where T is theism, on theism in evolution is high, and that's the way that Plantinga counsels. But another, simpler way is to alter in some way one's conditional judgments involving N and E. Perhaps one retains the original judgment that the probability of R on N and E is low, but reflecting that the probability of R is high, what else? Judges that it must have been that the particular contingent way that unguided evolutionary processes gave rise to us, and let's assign the letter W to some proposition that specifies obliquely whatever that particular contingent way is, resulted in creatures with basic cognitive reliability. So the probability of R on N and E may be low, but the probability of R on N and E and W is high, as is the probability of W. R, one comes to believe, is highly probable on one's total evidence. Problem solved. That's it.
Thanks. Well, like John earlier today, I would like to thank the organizers of the conference for giving me the chance to be here, and especially enjoyed talking with a number of the graduate students. And I understand many of you were also responsible for my being here. And thanks to Tim for a very clear summary of my paper and especially clear handout. I couldn't have done it better myself, except I would have made the font bigger. And very helpful comments, and I'm relieved that they're not more harshly or disturbingly addressed to the things I've said in the paper, but they go on and advance the discussion of planning his argument. I guess I should say one thing about Tim mentioned that I had been a student of planning, as indeed I was as an undergrad and then a seminar in graduate school. So I hope this paper, by criticizing him, is not one of those cases of academic patricide. But I think I maybe am a little bit entitled to start doing stuff like that, because for many years I just had a complete inability to find anything Plantinga has said anything other than obvious. And he said it, I thought, oh, of course that's right. Why would anyone else think otherwise? In fact, my classmates made fun of me in a seminar on world in essence, and I was grinning and nodding the whole time, and they were trying to think of counterexamples. So many Americans my age or older can tell you exactly where they were when they heard that JFK was assassinated. I can tell you exactly where I was the first time I thought that something Plantinga said wasn't true. I was preparing comments on an early draft of his paper on Occam's Way Out. And that's a paper in which he talks about accidental necessity. And he says that accidental necessity is closed under entailment of contingent propositions. And then he gives a definition, which wasn't closed under entailment of contingent propositions. I jumped out of my chair and I yelled in my house, "Hoist on his own petard." Well, so even in objecting to Plantinga, I still talked like him. I say that by way of background. I spent so many years of my life agreeing with everything. I think maybe it's time to start disagreeing with some of it. I did want to make maybe one or two clarifications to what I thought I was doing in the paper, as reported by Tim. Early on, he said that this look at Plantinga's account of defeat was all in the service of getting in a position to take a look at the evolutionary argument against naturalism. Well, really, I was kind of driven to look at that because I was first interested in looking at what Plantinga said about defeat. He mentions it in lots of publications. He says it's really important. He says there's undercutting defeaters and rebutting defeaters. It's pervasive. It's really important part of our design plan. And then he gave a definition that I just couldn't figure out. I mean, not merely because it was really complicated and it was a counterfactual, which probably has some exceptions to it, but because it went like this. On Plantinga's view, one belief D defeats an earlier, another belief B, just in case in a properly functioning noetic structure that's got B in it, that then acquires the new belief D, in such a properly functioning noetic structure, that structure kicks out the original belief B. But there's no explanation of what it's doing. When you get this new belief, and if you're functioning properly, suddenly your old belief is just ejected. But there's no explanation of, oh, I see the way your properly functioning noetic faculties are working here is they're assessing evidential relations between these various propositions, and on the basis of some principles having to do with justification, it assesses that your original belief is not justified, so it drops it. No explanation. So in the paper, I describe this conception of defeat as a black box. You just don't know what's going on in there. At any rate, Plantinga doesn't say what's going on in there. And then he gives a lot of examples in which it still seems not to be playing any role. And I want to say in a minute what I mean by not playing any role, but because that's Tim's first critical point. But the point I wanted to make first was, I started thinking about what he meant by defeat, and I couldn't understand it at all because I thought he didn't say enough about it, and it played no role, which, as I said, I will try to explain in a minute or defend. And then it occurred to me that there is a place in his writings where it does play a role. It plays a role in the evolutionary argument against naturalism because he makes some claims that some propositions defeat some other propositions. So at least there we've got some data that defeat is supposed to work like this to make those claims true. So that's how come the paper ended up talking about the evolutionary argument against naturalism. But then once you start talking about that, it's tempting to try to figure out where it goes wrong. So I couldn't resist picking one premise to quibble with. But the general thing I tried to conclude at that spot was simply, Plantinga's account of defeat in particular seems to me doesn't help with that argument. And we can talk more about that if you are interested. And one more thing about, see, I was introduced to the idea of defeat back in the old days, right after Gettier, when the standard idea was, okay, knowledge, S believes P just in case, and S knows P just in case P is true, S believes P, S is justified in believing P, and the fourth condition, whatever that is, to avoid the Gettier problem, or to avoid Gettier objections. And one of the proposals in those days was that there be no defeater. And ancient history there, but a big discussion of that as one of the ways of avoiding the Gettier problem. So naturally, when I started reading Planning on Defeat, I thought, oh, okay, so is this that fit into that mold where one of the conditions on knowledge is that there be no defeater? And it isn't. It's not part of that at all. That wasn't his plan at all. It's not his intention. That's not how he sets things up. But some commentators have actually said he's got a no-defeater condition, and he does it. So I said this. On Plantinga's view, you don't have to satisfy a separate no-defeater condition, by which I mean there's no fourth condition that his stuff about defeat is fitting into, in order to have warrant or knowledge. If your faculties are functioning properly to produce the belief B, then they haven't kicked B out. If they haven't kicked B out in response to some other belief you've acquired. So Tim says, but you might sometimes need to tell whether a person has a defeater for belief B in order to tell whether she knows that B. I think that is often true, that maybe there's something that's not an essential condition of something or other, but in order to determine whether something satisfies the general thing, you have to look at something related or look at something else. And maybe this is right if we're just appealing to an intuitive or an ordinary concept of defeat, but I just don't see that it holds on Plantinga's account. One thought, and this is really weak evidence, his own practice, when he considers some of these examples that Tim alluded to, does the theist have a defeater for theism, given what Freud says, or given the pervasive distribution of evil in the world? Plantinga says, well, the theist belief in theism was produced by properly functioning noetic faculties. So, of course, she doesn't have a defeater. So it's not like he first investigates whether there's a defeater. He just says, well, if you've got a belief that's produced by properly functioning noetic faculties, follows that you don't have any defeaters. So I guess I still think that. With one qualification, and I probably should have said this sooner. It's not that you don't have any defeaters on this view for knowledge. It's rather you don't have any undefeated defeaters. That is, you could have a defeater for a while, provided you got another proposition later that came and defeated it. So here's one of the standard examples. The widgets look red, so I believe the widgets are red. And then the foreman says, well, there's a red light shining on the widgets. So I now have a defeater for the proposition, for my belief that the widgets are red. And then the worker says, well, the foreman hasn't noticed, but we got rid of those red lights months ago. So now I have a defeater for the defeater, and it's in the clear to believe that the widgets are red. So just to make it slightly more complicated, it's not that the claim that there aren't any defeaters, if you warranted you'd have no defeaters, rather, if you warranted you have no undefeated defeaters. But that's just a consequence of having a belief produced in you by properly functioning noetic faculties. So, that's the response to Tim's criticism. Then the rest of what Tim talked about was, actual stuff about the evolutionary argument against naturalism. And I'm conjecturing that some of you will be more interested in talking about that too. So I want to say two things. One brief one is that I kind of like Tim's idea that if you can somehow figure out a way of how to assign the probabilities here, and you think you're in winning situation W, the winning situation where the brute forces of evolution worked in such a way that we really did come to have reliable noetic faculties. Well, given that, then it is highly probable that our noetic faculties are reliable. Indeed, that would, stated properly, it entails that. So I kind of like that idea. I'm just skeptical. I shouldn't say this to you people because you've been doing it all conference, assigning numbers to these prior probabilities or whatever. So.
You have difficulty doing that?
I do.
Really?
At least in, I mean, in any non-random way, right.
I mean, at least up to the third decimal you can't do.
So I just want to propose a different idea for discussion, more extreme proposal. Here it is. Warrant. What's it good for? I was wondering if anyone would get that, and I guess not, but isn't there some song, War, What's It Good For?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just said warrant, what's it good for?
Yeah, Brian left out his singing. Yeah, sorry, that's a separate story.
Here's the idea. Why can't the evolutionary naturalist say in response to Plantinga's argument, well, look, it's not all that important to have properly functioning noetic faculties. Who cares? We're not flouting any epistemic obligations. We're not flouting any epistemic norms by having beliefs like this, by having a belief. The evolutionary naturalist says, I think my faculties are reliable. I think evolutionary theory is true. I think naturalism is true. If you think my faculties aren't functioning properly, I say, so what's the big deal about having properly functioning faculties? Maybe I'm better off without. Because after all, Plantinga keeps emphasizing having your faculties functioning properly isn't following any epistemic norms. It's not satisfying any deontic obligations. It's to be in a certain state. And maybe the evolutionary naturalist would like to be in the following state. Having a lot of beliefs justified by evidence in various ways and related to other beliefs with various evidential connections. And so typically, I mean, unless you take mind-altering drugs or so, typically how our faculties function is out of our control. But I can latch on to these beliefs by weighing considerations of evidence, and I'm happy doing that. I still have lots of beliefs supported and based on evidence. So I still have lots of justification. So maybe according to the evolutionary naturalist, the system is like this. So on the one hand, I've got hands. On both hands, I've got hands. And other propositions that are just there, to use the term that Plantinga uses in describing noetics, structures, they just have a real depth of ingression. They're really central. They're about as obvious as anything could be. And lots of other things are like that. Lots of other things I believe are connected to them in various ways. And then on the other side, there's this evolutionary argument against naturalism. And it's kind of troubling. And you know, lots of people have raised objections to one or another of the premises, but I'm not really sure what to think about it. It's a little bit troubling, but I just soon hang on to that. I'm willing to have the beliefs and the premises of that argument until I can figure out a good reason to reject one or more of them. But I'm happy to have these beliefs, these premises perhaps as beliefs, and then these other beliefs as things I claim to know. And surely, if my faculties were functioning properly according to the way Plantinga says they would, on Plantinga's view, if they were functioning properly, what would happen is when I got the belief in E and N, it would kick out all my other beliefs. And I think that's a bad thing. I would hate to be lose all my other beliefs. Some of them are really nice beliefs, and I'd hate to lose them all. So if that's what it is to be functioning properly, I don't want it. I want what I have instead right now. A lot of things, some believe more strongly than others, some better supported than others, and maybe some not so obviously compatible, but I'll worry about that later. So maybe the idea here is something like this. Suppose your computer's operating system has the capacity to erase your hard drive if you try to save a certain file to it. And then you do try to save that file to it, because it's a file you wanted. Well, you could be grateful if your computer isn't functioning properly, because if it was functioning properly, it would wipe your hard drive, and you don't want that. You want all of your original files and plus the new one. Maybe you would like the new one quarantined in some way, but you wouldn't want all of them wiped out. So there's a random thought.
Okay.
Max.
Yeah, so, well, this is a question for Tim's move, which you seem to endorse as well. So, there's just a worry here, like, do we think that this is a good way to reason in general? I mean, suppose you've got a case where there's a bucket of 100 pills, you've got to take one of them. And 99 of these pills will massively impair your faculties, but from the inside it will seem like everything's going well. Just one of them won't. Like, do we get to say, like, the probability of R given this pill-taking situation in general is low, right? Because 99 of them will impair you badly. Do you get to conditionalize on plus, oh yeah, I took the pill that doesn't massively impair me? I mean, and if you think that's bad, why is your proposal why is it different from disadvantages?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Two things. I don't know if this is actually amplifying. Okay, didn't know if I needed to be. This was doing this. So one is, I mean, I think it's very important that R, as Plantinga sets it up, is this very general proposition about broad-based cognitive reliability, as opposed to, say, visual, you know, a special case. I guess I am inclined, even in that case, and I want to say something further about your case, but my inclination is to say, suppose I come to have good reason to suppose that in 99 cases, if I take this pill, I'll have this broad-based, massive cognitive unreliability. I'll be insane, right? And quite literally, and I won't reason. Everything's just mathematical reasoning, elementary logical reasoning. It's all unreliable. Okay. I can't see how I can reasonably come to accept that consequence, right? I mean, that's a breakdown of rationality, right? So
do you think there's some kind of a priori way to tell that we're in a good case? That seems to be what you're hinting at. Like,
well, no, not you know, way to tell. I think R occupies this privileged, anytime I reflect on R, right, if I so much as consider it, I'm entitled to assign it extremely high, in fact, probability one, I guess I would say. And it's not that I need some way to tell, I don't need to discern, and I'm entitled to reason from R, including in these kind of extreme scenarios. The second thing I wanted to say was, you know, this is a sort of special, well, maybe I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Thanks, Ed, for your paper. I'm not sure if this counts as defending Al or not, but I don't think he needs to rely on proper function to make the points that he's making. I don't think he needs to rely on it to help us understand what defeaters are, and he doesn't need to rely on proper function in order to make the evolution argument against naturalism work just as well as it would without talking about proper function, whether that's successful or not, I guess is another question. First of all, defeaters, I mean, the way you can think about defeaters is this. So he has this, on the second page of your handout at the top, there's that long clause two, which mentions proper function. What you could say is keep the first part, it's a purely epistemic defeater, if S is a metric structure N includes B, and S comes to believe D, and then for the second clause you can just say, and the epistemically fitting response for S in this circumstance is to withhold B. Now there are many ways to spell out what counts as the epistemically fitting response. You could do it the evidentialist way, you could do it a reliabilist way, you could do it in terms of probability, and planning does it in terms of proper function, but that's not crucial to explaining what a defeater is. And of course, the way I just put it is sort of uncontroversially true. That is, if it's not epistemically fitting for the if it's epistemically fitting for the person to withhold, and I guess we could add as sort of an obvious point that it's also epistemically unfitting for the person to keep believing it, well then that belief is defeated. It no longer has justification or knowledge. So that's a way of thinking about defeaters without bringing in proper function. And then the way the argument's supposed to work is, this is controversial, but I think it's got nothing to do with proper function. But the controversial claim is, and I think it's actually, you know, quite a plausible claim. Take any belief of yours. This is kind of with what Marie was talking about yesterday. take any belief of yours. If you think that belief was formed, you know, in an unreliable or untrustworthy or improper, you know, presumably inappropriate way, that's a reason to give up that belief. And that's what happens in the case of the evolutionary argument against naturalism. If you think R was formed in an unreliable way, if you really think that, well, then that's a reason not to hold any of your beliefs. Sorry, if you think your faculty is unreliable, then you think all of your beliefs were formed in this unreliable way. And you pointed out how, you know, we didn't rely on R to, you know, to come to believe that there's a chair here. But that doesn't matter, right? If I believe there's a chair here, relying on my perception, and then I come to think my belief that there's a chair here is unreliably formed, that's a defeater for my belief that there's a chair here. And even if I didn't depend on the reliability of that belief to begin with. So I think the whole story could be told basically as plausibly, some might say more plausibly, but at least as plausibly without bringing in proper function. And you seem to be saying that it really relies on his
No, function. No. I completely agree with what you said.
Okay. Good.
That is, I think, and Plantinga is explicit that the evolutionary argument against naturalism, well, he's not explicit that it doesn't depend on his eccentric concept of defeat, but he's explicit that it doesn't depend on his account of warrant. I mean, he says, this argument does not presuppose that warrant has proper functioning or any other epistemology. So he thinks it's neutral between different views. And if it doesn't depend on his view of warrant as proper functioning, I'm assuming he thinks it also doesn't depend on his view of defeat as a relation or something to do with proper functioning. So I think you're absolutely right. That is how Plantinga's argument, I think, should be understood. Is not depending on a particular interpretation. And then at the end you said its argument might be better without his own concept. And I agree with that too. It's not there. It's in the paper I tried to set it up as follows. I said, suppose defeat is as we normally think of it, as probably new evidence that it counts against something we've previously believed or undermines our justification for something we believe. And think of the argument that way. Now, I don't have anything really good to say about the way you just presented the argument under that interpretation. Only because I'm inclined to think, right, yeah, but then also these other beliefs over here, they're just so clear to me. How could I possibly give them up? I don't have anything insightful to say about the way you put it. My only point was, with looking at Plantinga's own account of proper functioning, I think the argument is less persuasive. And the reason is he hasn't told us what goes on in the proper functioning involving defeat. And you might think that if I'm an evolutionary naturalist, when I acquire that belief, proper functioning would somehow isolate it and preserve all of the more central beliefs, the ones that have greater depth of ingression, rather than kicking them all out, especially if the proper functioning was part of God's design plan. I mean, if he makes the rain fall on the just and the unjust, surely he would want truths to be believed by both the just and the unjust. If the design plan really was made by God, aimed at getting people to believe truths, he wouldn't set it up in such a way that you get in that R is low and everything else is gone. Probability of R is, and everything else is gone. He'd set it up in some more sophisticated way. So I think the argument's less plausible using Plantinga's account of defeat. He explicitly says you don't need his theory of knowledge to evaluate the argument. You're absolutely right about that. And I didn't have anything really insightful to say about, well, why should we reject that premise except to say, but surely there are these other things that are just so clearly true to us. We can't just say, oh, well, I can't tell how they were arrived at, so I better give them up. No, I can't. They're too vivid for that. But that's not a great argument. But
I did just want to say that, I mean, even on that way of setting it up, Tim's response is prima facie decisive because there are enhancements of NNA. Noetic structures, there are enhancements of NNA that entail that your beliefs were reliably formed. I mean, that's basically what, I mean, it's not like that setup, boy. I mean, that's basically going to be what you say back is right. That it's your entire body of evidence that's relevant, and if your entire body of evidence includes NNA plus other stuff, and then that makes it, you don't really think of what you believe is your evidence, but I'm playing off, you know, but then your body of beliefs positively encourages. I mean, that's the structure of, so it's not a setup that sort of avoids that criticism.
Right, so especially then if you would allow that, I'm not an evolutionary naturalist because I'm not a naturalist, but I'll speak as one. So suppose I acquire the belief in evolution and in naturalism, and now wonder about these other things. If you let
another thing you believe is, you know, you have hands.
Right. If you let me keep that belief that it seems to me that I have hands. I do have hands. There are other people. They've got hands, and I'm building up and up. And it seems to me that would let me sort of generate. Well, maybe that would let me generate a whole bunch of beliefs for which I could be confident. Well, my faculties are functioning reliably in letting me get these beliefs, or I'm justified in all of these beliefs, so it can't be that I'm not justified in anything else. So if you could sort of build them up again.
Well, you don't have to build them up, but I mean, your point would be they're there. You've got all this as part of your evidence, so in effect,
it's supplying
for you through a bunch of particulars. What I was saying, you can help yourself to some general proposition. In effect, something like that falls on the fact that you believe all these other things.
So if it's okay to have a bunch of particular beliefs,
because insofar as they point to a high, all things considered, probability of R, they point to, it's having been, Mike, I think, is going to tell us what's wrong.
I'm surprised that, I mean, what would you say about this example? You work for the government, and they have a pill that makes you, you know, have all your faculties reliable. And then that day, you know, you're having lunch with somebody, and they, at the end of the lunch, they say, I put that thing, it's going to get activated in, you know, a minute. I mean, I'm asking you to think, what would you think under those circumstances? Because you know that it works. I shouldn't work at such factories, by the way, but I mean, if you work there, you know that it works. Wouldn't that make you seriously worry about all your beliefs?
Not if you're thinking properly.
Okay.
Well, you ought to say no.
I think you should worry about them. I would.
Yeah. No, I mean, Sosa has examples of pills like that, right? And I've thought about that a little bit.
How do I know it? Because I've seen people, they start talking like blithering idiots, and it's awful, you know, and they're just kind of foaming at the mouth. And look at myself, I say, that's not happening to me. I'm good.
Yeah.
I can think clearly. Look at all these things I know. Yep, I can still do my inferences okay, just as well as possible.
Yes, you need better evidence that it seems just fine from the inside. So however you get that evidence.
That I need better evidence?
So what I'm saying is we need to describe a case where you have evidence that from the inside things seem fine. Maybe that'd be hard to spell that out, but if you can get evidence that from the inside things seem fine to these people, and yet things aren't fine. So you think we couldn't design a pill like that we knew worked? Is that your point?
Well, a worry would be because how do they communicate to us?
Yeah.
Ours low. But we do brain scans or something.
Yeah. Or maybe they can do a little bit of communicating. But we need some kind of significant unreliability, though.
Yeah.
And if we can have evidence for that, then we can be worried about ourselves, I think, getting such a pill.
So I was thinking about your idea about bootstrapping up from common sense beliefs in a sort of, more ingredient sense. So a couple of years ago, there was this paper in Biology and Philosophy where there is this, by Sullivan, I think, and he takes this example of deer flies. So deer flies, they don't really see like people and trees and all, they just see medium-sized moving objects and things that aren't medium-sized moving objects. And then they sort of go towards the medium-sized moving objects and they try to suck blood, and sometimes that works, and sometimes it's like cars and then they just die horribly. And so his idea is that they might have like something like common sense beliefs, like I see a middle-sized moving object, but they don't have that because their evolved beliefs don't track truth. So maybe then in some way, I don't know how to cash this out, I'll believe that we don't have hands, that we have hands is false in some way. I mean,
but, well, doesn't it just seem that our own beliefs are so much more detailed and vivid and compelling?
I mean, like a reflective deer fly might think, you know, I have really detailed beliefs about, you know, I have like
Yeah. No, I doubt the deer fly has any beliefs about its beliefs.
No, I mean, it's just an alien deer fly or something.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a question about Pontingus conditions and being in the future. I mean, the kind of thing Mike was proposing would, I think, avoid these worries. So can you first tell me, I mean, if a proposition can't be rationally accepted, does it follow that no being with properly functioning abilities would believe that proposition? I take it does.
Sorry, you're looking at me.
If a proposition can't be rationally accepted, then no being with properly functioning abilities would believe that proposition.
I think Plantinga thinks that.
Yeah.
Because he often gives these kind of self-referential arguments where there's a problem with a premise where you just can never be in a position rationally to believe it.
That no being with properly functioning abilities would believe, right? But now there's something really funny in generating the conclusion that I would ask the defeater for R, because condition two is a conditional, right? And I'm not sure whether to read it as a material or some kind of counterfactual conditional. But if he's a proposition that no being with properly functioning abilities would believe in the first place, right, then the antecedent of the conditional is never satisfied. So if it's a material conditional, it's trivially true. So if D's a proposition then that no being with properly functioning abilities would accept or believe, then condition two would be trivially satisfied. D would be a defeater for any belief whatsoever. Well, if it's a counterfactual conditional, then I'm not sure how to evaluate it because it hasn't necessarily false antecedent. So what I'm saying is there's something really funny going on because he's generating the conclusion that NNE can't be rationally accepted, but then it follows that no being with properly functioning abilities would believe in NNE. But to get to that condition, he had to sort of apply his his account of where the defeater is, which asks us to evaluate what a being with properly functioning abilities who believes NNE would do, right? But that presumably is metaphysically impossible. I'm just confused about this. I mean, there's something.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's right, even though I don't know exactly how to parse that conditional. I do think it is a counterfactual. I don't know quite what the quantifier ranges over. If it's for anybody with exactly your noetic structure, that would only be you, presumably. But at any rate, I think you're. So I'm going to answer this by saying I don't know exactly what conditional that is, but whatever one it is, it does seem that if a proposition can't be rationally believed, then it's never a defeater because it's never the case that someone gets it into their noetic structure with the result that something else gets kicked out.
It's never the case that someone with properly functioning
right.
gets it.
Right.
Into.
Yes. Right. Right.
So, I mean. I guess the kind of thing Mike was proposing would sort of avoid that kind of worry because you're just catching up condition two in terms of just what the epistemically fitting response is.
What's epistemically fitting once you add this one?
Right, but I mean there seems to be a kind of really problematic.
But no, I just said epistemically fitting once you add it, but again, you shouldn't put it that way. It's just, right, because you can't add it.
Well, I mean.
Oh, you could add it if you're not functioning properly. Okay.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
No, you can't do that either. I take it back. You're right. Your example is you can't rationally believe it. You could irrationally believe it. And so you irrationally believe it, but it's not properly fitting once you're doing that to believe this other thing. Right. That'll work.
So you're saying that I'm planning this own view with defeat is it's false that. You have defeater for the relevant beliefs. I'm just wondering what's wrong with this, an even stronger version of the argument, which is on Plantinga's view of knowledge, these premises, or at least the core insight of the evolutionary argument, is compatible with the natural still knowing. So I'm thinking, I'm looking at the capsule summary on page one of when a belief was formed. And you might think, well, proper functioning is the kind of thing that comes in degrees, like something can be properly functioning a little bit better. You know, it's one thing to be functioning a little bit better than another, but the second thing still functioning pretty well. And you might think, we've got a naturalist here believing she has hands and the sun's out and things like that. And that's it is satisfying a whole bunch of the criteria for proper functioning in that case, because you're in the right environment, she's using vision, stuff like that. And then there's this little extra fact that one of the things in her noetic structure is this belief that her perceptual faculties are likely to be unreliable. And so, I mean, that might knock down the proper functioning score a little bit, but I'm just curious why you can't, it still couldn't be true that this naturalist functioning, or beliefs, things are functioning pretty well still, and so she'd be kind of knowing these things as long as they're also true.
And that sounds right, and I didn't quite get the case. Would it be a case that planning would say, is it really a case in which your other beliefs are defeated?
I'm just thinking, if you're just trying to fit defeat into this overall proper, just as it, like, you're trying to fit defeat into a lack of proper function, it seems like you're going to have to balance it against all these other considerations. All these other ways in which something can be functioning well or not. This thing, you're still meeting a whole bunch of these criteria when you've got.
That seems right, and it does seem that yet another way to make the theory more complicated is to recognize degrees of proper functioning, or how close the proper functioning, and sometimes close enough might be good enough for enough warrant for knowledge.
Just on that, I mean, I think it's important to see that if you, I mean, this is in support of it. If you're going to run the defeat, rely on the defeat argument, you must already think there was something bad about Max's analogy. Because in Max's setup, you didn't get to know, intuitively, you don't get to know anything visually in the first place. If you think evolution makes things that bad, there's absolutely no point running a defeat argument. You just run a straightforward argument saying, hey, it's like that bucket case, you never know anything in the first place, whether or not you believe in metaphysical naturalism. So what you guys have got to do is draw a very fine, you know, it's a very weird path where you say, that's a terrible analogy, Max. It's nothing like that in the evolution good case. You do get to know. But it's still, you're not, you know, epistemologically so robust such that, you know, coming to learn a bit of the science will allow your knowledge to survive in it. It seems very, very strange, that path. It seems much more natural to go all in and say you couldn't know in the first place. It's just like the pill situation if you're going to be running this at all.
Well, I mean, the Max case is at a certain point in time. Nothing calls into question that I've had reliable beliefs until I've taken it. So to make it a direct analog, we would have to say it's, the hypothesis is you were given this at birth. 99 out of 100 babies at your hospital were given the pill or something like that. And then what you say.
But are we saying that after a while you do come to know all this? You know, it doesn't stop you.
Right.
I mean, that's the first question without even getting into defeat. Right. We've got to get to the question.
Do you get
to know after time goes by? It's quite a while since you lucked out with the pill. Do you start? I mean,
if you don't, then
we don't have to worry about defeat.
When I'm confronted with the argument, to grasp the argument, right, I have to assume I know something.
We're gods looking from the outside. Let's just forget defeat and just ask, does this person know when they take the pill and time goes by? Do they start knowing after a while? I mean, just do that first. And that's got nothing to do with defeat. A lot of what's getting mixed in here is the thought, that's not good enough to know. That the risk that you took, that the lottery stops you knowing. But, you know, that's one strand of this argument. It's got nothing to do with defeat. And that's what Max was relying on, which has nothing to do with defeat, that kind of analogy. And that gets thrown into the pot. It's not a defeat argument. It's the more straightforward argument that Billy was going for. And I feel it confuses things to mix that in with the defeat argument.
Yeah. Well, this is a slightly different point, broader.
So we have two follow-up.
Okay.
If I'm understanding what you're getting at, I mean, say the case is 99 people in the hospital that day out of 100 were given this pill. You weren't giving the pill. To make it analogous, I mean, Plantinga doesn't think, in fact, naturalism and evolution are true, so he thinks, you know, they do have reliable faculties. You weren't given the pill. Nonetheless, you know, you were at high risk of being given the pill, of course, and then later on you learn.
You must forget, okay, you don't learn anything. Do you now not know?
Yeah, no, I think you do know. So I think this is a good analogy because I think you know. There's a sense in which something's unsustainable.
I see, so what you're talking about is not the...
It's not the lack of knowledge. The question is...
So we've got two things. We've got how the guy in the evolutionary world does, who's, as it were, running the pill thing. And we can describe the epistemic situation and ask if he knows before, prior to defeat. And we can also ask
in
the God world, what happens?
Yeah. So I think you can say yes.
And you're running it just in the God world, as it were. Is that the thing?
Yeah.
Right.
So atheists can still have knowledge.
That's right, as long as they don't learn his argument. So he's doing a bad thing for people.
Given evolutionary theory, one can assume that it's going to track survival and reproductive success. Therefore, within that, one can assume that one does know that one has hands, because that's going to be rather vital for living in this world. But given that theory, I don't see why one should have any reason for thinking that one can either believe in evolutionary theory or, in fact, believe in metaphysical naturalism, both of which may not track reproductive success, for instance, unless you make all the money out of writing books about it or something. But I mean, it seems to be different from the actual content, whereas having a hand seems to be rather crucial for it.
I'm not sure I quite got that. Having a hand does seem pretty important for our reproductive fitness.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's right. My point. Whereas, but philosophical scientific beliefs aren't. But, therefore, right. There's a distinction between the two.
Right. But the belief that I have a hand, or that I have the true belief that I have a hand, seems less important. I didn't talk at all about Plantinga's support for premise one of his argument, and it's in part because I didn't want to make this the paper about the evolutionary argument against naturalism, and in part because I didn't know what to think about it, because he has a very complicated argument designed to show that what matters for evolution, for evolutionary fitness, is that you have the right combination of beliefs and desires that make you get your body in places and do things according to which you reproduce. And it doesn't matter whether those beliefs are tracking truth or not. For that, you could, I mean, he doesn't say this, but you could imagine, you could have an inverted spectrum, for example, and still do just as fine in succeeding in passing on your genes. So I don't know what to make of that argument, but Plantinga does think that on evolutionary theory, there's no special reason to think that we're good at truth. What we can have these contents of our, but they don't have to track the truth, as long as what they do is they enable us to get in the right place to reproduce.
So they don't track truth even in a limited area?
No. Well, they might not, at any rate, he says.
Yeah. But, I mean, if I could just pick up on this. I think it's unconvincing what Al says about that, this more general claim that about ordinary beliefs and desires that would intuitively seem relevant to reproductive success. He says, well, you know, it's possible that, you know, you've got a weird package such that you get around in the world. You're Mr. Magoo, if any of you know that American cartoon from long ago. You know, you stumble around, but things, you function okay, even though your beliefs and desires wildly mismatch. By a fortuitous coincidence, that your beliefs and desires mismatch in the right way. And functionalists might have problems about saying, well, that means you do have beliefs and desires after all, which is the right. All right, put all that aside. The interesting point you're making is someone could run a more limited version of Plantinga's argument. In fact, Al himself, and at least I remember in the early formulations, he said, at any rate, when it comes to things like belief in evolutionary naturalism, they're highly theoretical kinds of beliefs, we should be less confident of the conditional the reliability of those. Whatever mechanisms are at work in doing sophisticated science and mathematics, that it's part of doing science, philosophical reasoning and that sort of thing. Suppose someone thought that was more a more plausible, because a more limited target
and it still yields the result that he wants, that it kind of undermines and provides a defeat for evolutionary naturalism. I mean, one thing that's interesting, if you go that route, my emphasis on, well, R is so massive, you know, it's so central to our cognitive system, you can't have a defeat for it. Someone might say, no, you can be skeptical. It's not total cognitive shipwreck to give up sophisticated forms of reasoning and say, I don't have confidence in that. I can still have a lot of ordinary beliefs about the world. So it becomes, I think, a more interesting argument, because the crucial premise that drives the argument about the conditional probability is more plausible.
I wanted to ask about, basically how defeat relates with warrant and knowledge. So in the purely epistemic defeater, it's supposed to be a rational defeater, so one of your beliefs is defeated in that way, then it's not rational. And in the paper you say, if a belief is defeated in that way, then it won't satisfy the condition for warrant, so it won't be knowledge. So that's why if you have knowledge, then your belief is not defeated. But I didn't see how it followed, so I'm wondering, can we actually get that? So from the definition, basically from the definition of warrant, it should follow that a belief is not defeated, or from the definition of defeat, it should follow that a defeated belief is not warranted. So the reason why it didn't follow is roughly that, at most what you can say is that if you have a defeated belief, then there is something that doesn't function properly in you, but it doesn't follow that your belief that B is not produced by properly functioning faculty.
Right, you have, if you're believing a proposition is defeated, there's something wrong going on, but it needn't be your belief.
No.
I think it would be tricky to think of a case in which it's not the belief, or maybe this could be right. Maybe there's more than one way to. There's a choice of propositions to give up, so that perhaps a belief is produced in you, and then the story always says produced in you, and then you have to add and maintained in you by properly functioning noetic faculties. So I suppose it could be that emphasize the counterfactual here, acquire a belief which is such that somebody like you who got that belief but was functioning properly would eject B. Closest world in which someone gets that belief, they would eject B. But maybe there's another way to get around it. Maybe there's something else you could give up instead, right? In which case, B might be left intact and then you might still be functioning properly. But I do think in general, if it turns out that you, let's ask whether a certain belief you have is defeated. That is to say, do you have some other belief? Ignore the undefeated defeater distinction. Do you have some other belief which is like this? If you were to acquire it and you were functioning properly, you jettison B. The answer is no, you don't. Then you're functioning properly.
I don't know which way to go. For instance, you have this belief that B that's been formed initially in a proper way, say
right.
Perception, and then you get this straightforward defeater D, which is basically like somebody tells you that the proposition is false, and you just, this function about D, you just dismiss that. Maybe you don't realize the conflict,
right.
Or you just dismiss it. So something is wrong with you, but is your belief that B, thereby produced by non-functioning, not properly functioning faculty, doesn't seem to follow.
It wouldn't follow, I suppose, if there would be another way to get out of the problem, or acquiring the information that there's something wrong going on wasn't something that you have to add that this other information you get, the potential defeater, is something that you're getting it in a properly functioning way. So then ask yourself, so you acquire this new belief D, and D is really a defeater for your belief B. If it really is a defeater, then if you're functioning properly, you've gotten rid of belief B, so you don't have knowledge. You don't believe it, you don't have knowledge. If you're not functioning properly, and this is the part I think you're objecting to, if you're not functioning properly because you haven't gotten rid of B, it's tempting to say that in all but the most made up, hard, weird cases, your failure to be functioning properly at that point attaches to B, preventing you from being warranted in B. You got it in the right way, but you're not maintaining it in the right way, and you're not maintaining it in the right way because you've added a defeater for it. And if you don't drop it when you've got the defeater, you're not functioning properly for that. But we might have to pursue that afterwards. Yeah.
Okay, unless we have any other questions, just hang out to speak.